Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Hello again and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio today on this Medical Monday are Drs. Ira Zacon and Courtney Belomo. Both are from New York Oncology Hematology, which has renowned stem cell transplant center established in 1997, and whose clinical research trial operation has played a key role in the FDA approval of over two dozen anti-cancer drugs. Dr. Zacon is director of the New York Oncology Hematology Stem Cell Transplant Program. He completed a professional development program in autologous stem cell transplantation and hematologic malignancies at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston in 2012. He earned his medical degree and completed his internship and residency at McGill University in Montreal. He's board certified in internal medicine, medical oncology, and in hematology. Dr. Courtney Belomo is a very recent addition to the NYOH team, specializing in hematologic malignancies, benign hematology, and bone marrow transplantation. She earned her medical degree and completed her residency and fellowship at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New York, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. She's board certified in internal medicine and in medical oncology and hematology. Wow. Dr. Zacon, Dr. Belomo, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Yes, well, we love having you here, and it's going to be a terrific conversation. The phones are already beginning to ring. If you want to get in on this, these phones will be going like crazy. So let me ask you a real fast question. And by the way, you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, so I want to ask you a real fast question. These blood diseases, maybe you could just give us a short course for just a couple of seconds about some of the ones that you traditionally handle. Who wants to start?
I can start. So we actually see both benign diseases, so things like anemia, if someone has a blood clot. We also see things if someone has an elevated white blood cell count or an elevated platelet count. Those are all things that end up coming to us. But then we also have a whole field where we see really blood cancers, so leukemias, lymphomas, myelomas, which are cancers of different types of white blood cells.
The ones you just named, which would you least not like to have?
So they're all, honestly, I think they're all a little different, and there's a lot of our blood disorders can be chronic diseases. Some can be more acute in nature. So that's actually a really tough question that I don't know that I could answer.
Well, okay. I'd say there's many, many different types of, for example, lymphomas, which are cancers of white blood cells. And so some of them actually have very high cure rates. Some of them are harder to cure. Some of them may not be curable, and yet people may live a long time with them. But some of them we know that are more serious diseases that we will have difficulty curing with current therapies. So there are some rare forms of lymphomas, for example, called T-cell lymphomas, or any lymphoma that doesn't stay in remission and relapses sometimes can be, you know, a more serious disease, and that's true of the leukemias, which are cancers of different white blood cells of the blood system.
So my job is always to sort of think about what people on the other side of the radio are asking. So I want to ask you this number one question, which keeps the internet humming all the time. What are the symptoms of some of these?
So I think that the symptoms of a lot of these diseases are actually can be symptoms of blood counts being, you know, being a little out of whack. So people can be prone to bleeding sometimes. They can find that when they're walking a flight of stairs that they're a little short of breath. They can sometimes find that they're more tired. They can have fevers, night sweats. They can also have symptoms if a lymph node is growing. Everywhere you have blood vessels in the body, you have lymph nodes. So if a blood vessel, if a lymph node is growing in an area that may compress a nerve, sometimes people can have pain. But honestly, a lot of these symptoms can be
for everything else. Yeah.
Pretty innocuous and found on routine on routine blood work that they do.
Their
primary care physician does.
I have a friend who was walking on a golf course and just keeled over one day, and they found out he had one of these blood diseases. Yeah. So it's interesting. He didn't have any complaints before that. Anyway, if it's all right with you, I'd like to go to the phones. Is
absolutely.
That okay, guys?
Absolutely.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Okay, Jim, you're on.
I got a two-parter here. What is the incidence of developing leukemia after the use of chloramphenicol? And is it known how the metabolites of outdated tetracycline derivatives break down to form aplastic anemia?
Okay, before you answer that, guys, let me just tell you a little bit about this program. Most of us have no idea, although Jim certainly does, about what Jim just said. So the first thing you have to do is sort of tell us, break down the question so that the rest of us understand it. Okay, who wants to go first?
Sure, I'll begin there. So, you know, Jim, you're asking about, for the audience, chloramphenicol is an antibiotic that was used, many, many decades ago. It actually is no longer used because it was discovered that it could potentially cause kind of a toxic effect to the bone marrow. So the bone marrow inside our bones is what makes all of our blood and the cells in our blood. And so patients might be discovered to have very low blood counts, and it was found to be related to this antibiotic. It's been taken off the market for those purposes, and certainly even in my career, which now has been 25 years, I've learned about chloramphenicol, but never used it because it was no longer in the market. So that's he's referring to something called aplastic anemia. That is where the bone marrow is affected, where you don't have enough bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Aplastic means it's not growing. Uh-huh. And anemia is one, just means you have low red blood cell count, but it really, usually all the blood counts are low. There are other reasons that people can have aplastic anemia that have nothing to do with a toxic effect or a side effect of a medication. So the second part was asking about tetracycline, which is another form of antibiotic, also not commonly used anymore because there's others, although it's still around. It used to be used sometimes to treat acne that was very active.
Mm.
It does not have a significant association with, a bone marrow toxicity, and does not have any known association with the development of leukemias. I think that we always, should be cautious in any form of medications in young people, whether there be adolescents, say in that age, and when you're using anything over a long time. But maybe Jim could share what information he had.
Well, I was going to ask Jim that same question. What do you ask?
I was just wondering. I had a billy goat back in the 70s that we wound up giving tetracycline to. Back in those days, there wasn't any dates on the medication.
Right.
Interesting. Courtney, the other thing that used to go on a lot that doesn't go on that much is that x-rays were used on indiscriminately for a lot of different things. Do we think that x-ray from the 50s and 40s and when they were invented may be the cause of some of these things?
So we know that high doses of radiation, things like Chernobyl and Japanese World War II, things like that can absolutely, we know, lead to leukemia. We know that people can get secondary leukemias that affect the bone. So leukemia is really a blood cancer that originates from a problem within the bone marrow where you're unable to make mature white blood cells and you kind of stop that maturation process at baby white blood cells called blasts. And so we know that that can happen even in some patients who've had radiation therapy mm-hmm. to that area. So we know that radiation is a cause. Is there a lot of data that x-rays are enough to do that? I don't know that we really have that data, but we know that radiation can be associated with certain leukemias.
Well, I'll add to that, if
sure.
I may.
Sure.
We learned certainly, and this is outside of the blood cancers, because I used to also do oncology in general. For example, survivors of the Japanese nuclear bomb in
sure.
Hiroshima, there was a high incidence of cancers of the thyroid gland. It seems to be very sensitive to radiation exposures, and Well, if you go back to the 1950s and maybe early 60s, it was not uncommon sometimes for enlarged tonsils to give little bits of radiation, and there was an increased incidence of thyroid cancers. Now, that's not used anymore. Mm. We are very sensitive to the idea that, you know, we realize that X-rays are, we take pictures, they have some radiation. Things like CAT scans have absolutely more radiation to get the pictures. And I think we've become much more sensitive to the idea that there could be consequences if these are overused over someone's lifetime. We do worry most about children and adolescents because they're growing and their exposure could have more consequences. But I think when we order tests as physicians, we always have to be very thoughtful that how important is this test? Is it the best way I can get to the answer, or maybe the only way? And we try and balance the need versus any exposures. And you'll see less testing done, I think, in the future than it used to be.
Thank you. Hey, Jim, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it very much. And, Tom, we're going to be right with you. Just hold on there. We just got to take a few seconds out for a break.
Support comes from Nathan Latour Hospital and Nursing Home, welcoming surgeon Dr. Bennett Tojabi, a general surgeon specializing in minimally invasive surgical techniques, NLH.org. Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh, master's and online RN to BS in nursing degree programs for adult students, post-master's nurse practitioner certificates in adult and family health, msmc.edu. Ellis Medicine and Bellevue Women's Center, providing preventative heart disease screenings for women, ellismedicine.org. Storm King Art Center, a 500-acre sculpture park in Orange County, New York, offering programs for children and adults Sundays at 1 p.m., stormking.org. And Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com.
And we are back. We're delighted today to have two real experts on diseases of the blood. Perhaps you know somebody, perhaps you have a friend, but I have to tell you right now, my experience, every one of these phones will be busy from now on till the end of the show. However, right now, it's something that we seldom see around here. You have a real opportunity to get on the phone and ask the question, like Tom from Kingston, but it's 1-800-348-2551. No waiting. Okay, Tom, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Oh, perfectly.
Okay, great. I hope this question is within the purview of the doctors. We have a friend who has an 85-year-old mom who's got a bad knee, and she was not a good candidate for knee replacement surgery. She lives in Florida, and friends of hers recommended this doctor down there that's supposedly into this new field, I guess it's new, called regenerative medicine, wherein they harvest stem cells from this woman's body, and I think they grow them and then do some other processing and then inject this, you know, finished material back into the knee. And she's had, I think, two or three injections over time and claims that she has fantastic relief from her symptoms. And I'm wondering if the doctors know anything about this or the field of regenerative medicine in general.
So regenerative, it's slightly different than the stem cells that we're using right now, and I'll talk about them in a second. But I do think that there is an emerging field of regenerative medicine where a lot of the data is right now is actually in just like the lady that you're describing that has really orthopedic problems. That's really where they're using it right now. And they're able to kind of take those bone cells and regenerate them. There's not as people are certainly looking into it, but there's not as much data out there in the other organ types. Right now, the process that we do in the way of stem cell transplant is really the idea that we're collecting someone's stem cells. You're born with a set of stem cells in your bone marrow that are in charge of populating that factory throughout your whole life. And we actually collect them off of a machine before we do a stem cell transplant, and then we actually give that back to someone after giving a high dose of chemotherapy for certain diseases with the hope of putting that person in a really good remission. And so it's a little different what we do, but yes, regenerative medicine absolutely out there, primarily working in the orthopedic field right now. And we're hoping as things come down the pike that we'll be using more and more stem cells for different sorts of organs to help right. cure diseases.
Are you betting yes?
No, absolutely. I think really the idea is, you know, a stem cell is just a very young cell that can make other cells. We use bone marrow stem cells because we treat bone marrow blood diseases. But in fact, they're easy to get.
Sure.
And so there is a lot of research taking even bone marrow stem cells and in the laboratory changing their genetic program, which is kind of their genes that tell them to be this type of cell, and get them to be a different type of cell. So in the case that you're describing, it might be to become what we'd call a connective tissue cell, something that can help support a joint. There's a lot of interest in regenerating hearts after bad heart attacks or in a very weak heart, to inject cells that can become new heart cells instead of doing a heart transplant. There's a lot of interest in brain diseases where there's degeneration, Parkinson's disease, for example, where if you can get new fresh stem cells to become brain cells, they might repair.
Are they using them now?
In experimentally. We have the ability scientifically to kind of make these changes to cells, but getting them to work is a whole other challenge. But there are programs that are looking at continuing to try and make this better. I think it's also probably important for our audience and Tom to know the difference between stem cells that we come from embryos or embryo stem cells and the kind of stem cells we're talking about. They're all stem cells. An embryo stem cell is just the stem cell that becomes a human being, all the cells of a human being.
But this does get it out of the political context, doesn't it? I mean, in other words...
Well, that's where the controversy and the ethics are. Bone marrow stem cells don't have those ethics about them. They come from you can get them from me, and I can use my own stem cells if we were to use regenerative medicine approaches in the future.
Very interesting. Okay, Tom, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, two free phones, 1-800-348-2551. Lou in Utica. Okay, Lou, you're on.
Hi. My annual blood tests always come low in the values for MCV and MCH, occasionally low in hemoglobin and hematocrit. I've been told that I have thalassemia or Mediterranean anemia, and that it's harmless and there's nothing to be concerned about. Have any opinions?
Yeah, so I would agree that it's harmless and it's nothing to worry about. So everyone has in their red blood cell a molecule called hemoglobin, and that carries oxygen to your organs. And it actually comes as kind of a four-part molecule, two alpha chains and two beta chains. And so sometimes frequently people from the Mediterranean, but you can certainly see it in people of Indian descent or people of Japanese descent, where they just get a mutation in one of those genes. So the way you make your red blood cells is sometimes you have kind of a shifting towards more alpha chains because you have a problem with a beta. And so your MCV is typically down. It doesn't really ever bother you. It just means that you're threshold for what we might call normal is slightly lower than the average person, but 99 out of 100 people, it never bothers them. There are serious cases of things like thalassemia, but we typically pick them up in childhood. And so as an adult, I suspect it will never bother you.
Right. So,
well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot, Lou. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And that means that there's one free phone open because Lou hung up. Okay, so now we'll go to Jane in Albany. Jane, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an unusual, I've been told it's a fairly unusual lymphoma. It's Waldenstrom's.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor isn't even 100% sure that that's what it is, but he's fairly sure. I have apparently not one, but two aberrant proteins in my blood. My protein level has stayed fairly constant, about twice of what would normal be. And I also have peripheral neuropathy. The neuropathy is getting a little bit worse. I've had that now for about 5 or 6 years. The doctor is doing watchful waiting, and it's making me anxious. We can also go to Rituxan at any time. And I'm wondering what you would recommend with someone with my medical problem.
Okay. So first of all, it's always hard to recommend truly to you something without, you know, really seeing you. It's always important to know that. But you, Waldenstrom's, although not common, is certainly, you know, well known. You're not alone out there. So for the audience, too, Waldenstrom's is a, it's really a form of lymphoma, which is, again, a cancer of lymphocyte white blood cells that are called B cells. And but you referred to elevated proteins in your blood, and because these are white cells that make antibody proteins, like our immune system makes antibodies to fight infections. So it becomes a marker of the disease. Mm-hmm. And then there's certain features that helped us to diagnose whether it is Waldenstrom's, because some people may have a lymphoma that looks like it, but it's not really quite Waldenstrom's. But you certainly can have a neuropathy like you describe.
Neuropathy, just for the lay audience, is, you know, tingling in the hands or numbness.
Yep. Right. Thing. Typically tingling in the fingers or feet, sure. Numbness, sometimes uncomfortable. And it's the nerves that give us this feeling aren't working properly. And
it's definitely uncomfortable, and it is affecting my balance.
I'm
finding that my balance is getting, significantly worse.
Right, because we need to actually feel the ground, and our brain senses our position. And if we don't have that input, then we don't feel our balance is right. So, you know, there are reasons to treat Waldenstrom's, if that's clearly the diagnosis. And there sometimes are reasons to watch or observe. Some people have a very early form, very chronic, and it may go on for years and years. As long as there's no symptoms or issues that we think are related to the disease and are enough reason to treat, because then there are treatments. You mentioned one called Rituxan. That is a treatment that actually is an antibody itself. It's an engineered antibody that targets these B cells, of which Waldenstrom cells are, and can be a very effective treatment. That
now,
doesn't
go back a little bit. The B cells are white blood cells?
Yeah, so yes. They're white blood cells. They're called lymphocytes. We have different types of white blood cells, and in our immune system we have what are called B lymphocytes and T lymphocytes, and diseases that may come from these may be B cell lymphomas or T cell lymphomas, and Waldenstrom's is a form of B cell lymphoma that really exists in the bone marrow, inside our bones. And although there are certain types of chemotherapy that are used to treat Waldenstrom's, and that was the way we primarily treated it in years past, there's many new therapies that are very effective that are not really traditional chemotherapies besides Rituxan. And so this has become increasingly treatable disease. We certainly treat them. We also participate in a blood cancer research group of which we frequently will have trials for lymphomas and sometimes for Waldenstrom's. And we work closely with colleagues at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, of which there's Waldenstrom's experts. So, I think your doctor is choosing to observe. I presume then that there's not enough reason that he thinks or she thinks that there's time to treat it. But I think these are the questions you need to ask.
Well, I'm going to ask a very practical question. Somebody wanting to get in touch with you guys, how would they do it?
Through our NYOH office. That
NYOH, is that the way it's listed?
Yeah, it's okay. New York Oncology Hematology. You can find us on the web. We actually, although we specialize in hematology with three other members of our practice, we have a whole group of another 25 of us that do both oncology and hematology, and we have 7 different sites in the capital region. So any one of those would be able to handle any kind of blood or cancer disorder.
Okay, great. So thank you, Jane, for asking about that.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thanks
okay,
a lot.
That leaves one free phone now, and we'll go to Ed in Barrytown. Okay, Ed, you're on.
Hello?
Hey, Ed, you're on.
Okay. Well, I have a question, but I need to put forth a little history. My daughter was diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, and she got transfusions for 2 years, and this was like 5-6 years ago, so there was very little research done on it, apparently. And so then she got into a bone marrow program at University of Maryland. They did a transplant. It failed. Then they did another one, and now she appears to be in remission. She's doing well. But what does her future have in store for her? as far as.
So I think when you talk about, there's two kind of ways I think that when you talk about her future. One, you talk about her future in the way of the disease and what myelodysplasia is. And how old was your daughter?
She's in her 30s. She was born in 78. I don't know exactly how old she is.
No, that's fair. Okay, so I was born in 78, so I can tell you she's 35.
Yeah, 35. Yeah.
Courtney, she's younger than me.
Courtney, yeah. Ira, before we go further with this, let's talk about what the disease itself
right.
is. Okay.
So myelodysplasia is, we talked a little, I said a little bit earlier in the show about leukemia being the process of not having enough, not being able to mature your white blood cells. We consider myelodysplasia to be a pre-leukemia, so that you have some elements that you're not able to make enough healthy white blood cells. Your red blood cell line and your platelet may look a little funny and not normal. And so we know that if we left most people with myelodysplasia on their own, that they could eventually develop into a leukemia. And that's why we consider treating it. It tends to be a disease.
So dysplasia
more of the
is on
elderly,
the way is on the way too.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So let me just get a couple of things straight for everybody who's listening. You've talked about the evil of white blood cells gone awry. Mm-hmm. Can you get cancer of red blood cells too?
Yes. There are most of the cancers that we talk about, like, and we're saying leukemias, lymphomas, they actually are almost always of the white blood cells, which are much more abundant than many different types. There are certain conditions of the bone marrow that are very chronic, where they actually, it's a form of cancer that overproduces the cells, and one form overproduces red blood cells. And so we'll see patients referred because they have too many red blood cells in their blood. Now, the problem with that is most of our blood is red blood cells, and if you have too much, your blood gets thicker. And the thicker the blood, as you can imagine in the circulation, there's a risk that maybe that blood clots in the blood when it shouldn't. And that's, if it's your brain, that's a stroke. If it's your limb, you lose circulation to your limb. And so it's important to recognize this, because they are also treatable conditions, but they're very different. There's patients who can have these and live with them like a chronic condition for 20, 30 years, and we just have to try and keep their red cell level closer to normal so that they we can prevent some of those.
Okay, so now back to Ed and Barry time.
Yeah, so I think that in relation to the myelodysplasia, I think that if they're talking about her being cured, it's going to be something for easily the next up to 5 years before we really say someone is cured of their disease. So they'll watch her in the way of bone marrow biopsies, where they actually go in and take a little piece, and making sure that the person that gave her transplant is still the main immune system that she has. But what I think also her future lies, and this is throughout her life, is really unique to anyone that undergoes a bone marrow transplant. So not just patients with MDS, but really you worry, because what a bone marrow transplant is the concept, and it can be either from the peripheral blood or from actually taking a piece of the bone marrow, you get somebody else's stem cells. And so those stem cells can recognize the host, in this case, your daughter, some of her natural organs like her liver and her skin and her gut, as foreign. And sometimes when that happens, that's called graft versus host disease.
Yeah, she had GVH and she had host versus graft as well.
Right. And so that can happen at any point throughout her life. And so she always has to be monitored for that. But part of the unlike other transplants, what's unique about a stem cell or bone marrow transplant, and frequently we use those terms interchangeably, is that eventually we can get actually people off of what we call their immunosuppression. So suppressing this new immune system, unlike a kidney transplant where patients are on that for their entire life, with a bone marrow transplant, you can actually get off of that and have a normal life. We know that in people this young, that going through something like this can affect things like fertility and menopause, and having had gotten chemotherapy in the setting of her bone marrow transplant, whatever type of chemo she got, there will be unique side effects of that. But the reason we put patients through this is the hope that they will live a normal and healthy life for many, many years.
Now, Ed, I hope you understand that I'm not trying to give you the rush. We got every phone is blinking off the hook here. I want to try to get as many people in as possible. Thank you for the call.
And thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Let's go to Nona in Kingston.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Nona.
I have a reoccurring thing every few years where I get anemic, quite anemic, actually. And nobody yet has found any reason for it. It's been happening since, I was probably about 20 years old, and I'm 62 now, and the only thing that seems to, if I take iron pills or whatever, I don't absorb it. So that was never, you know, every time I would try it, even if you wrap it in raw meat or you drink it with vitamin C or whatever.
Wrap it in raw liver.
It never worked. So the only thing that seemed to have worked recently was to have an infusion of iron.
Right.
And that, I mean, I get down as low as 6, maybe 7, and that'll bring it up to about 12, maybe, and there have been times where I've gotten to 14.
What's normal?
But overall, it just, after 4 or 5 years, it happens again.
Okay.
Doc, what's normal?
So she's referring to a number we call hemoglobin, which mm-hmm. is just the big protein inside the red cells that carries oxygen. So normal for a woman typically is 12 to 13, 12 to 14. Men run generally a little higher, something like 14 to 15, 14 okay. to 16. So being down to 6 is like being on half tank.
sure.
And so does, and, but when you get the intravenous iron, it sounds like you do get better for a while?
Yes. I had that about 3 or 4 years ago, and so far I'm okay.
Good.
I hover in around 12,
okay.
11,
okay.
right in there.
So, you know, anemia, again, for our audience, means when we have low red blood cells. And the lower they are, the more we may start to feel tired, getting out of breath, can't do our normal things. And now there's many different causes of anemia. What you're describing is what we would call iron deficiency anemia. And some people can become iron deficient. Now, for a woman, there's different times in life that anemia may be for
sure.
different reasons. You know, when a younger woman has periods regularly, you lose some iron. When you get pregnant, you use a lot of iron. But it's clear that you're chronically tend to be iron deficient, and if you don't absorb the iron, we do routinely give intravenous iron, and it is a way to replenish it and correct the anemia, but then you have to be followed because you may deplete that iron over time and just need to be kind of replenished.
Yeah. Nona, I'm so sorry. We've got to take a break
okay.
now, and I appreciate your call. Really, thank you very much. Okay, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, Poughkeepsie, offering a graduate program in social work and graduate and undergraduate programs in nursing. Adelphi.edu. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond, 518-580-8080. Route 7 Grill, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, farm-to-table cuisine of locally sourced ingredients prepared by Chef Christophe Jalbert, featuring house-made charcuterie, route7grill.com for menu. And historic Huguenot Street, New Paltz, now open for the 2014 season with new period house interpretations, special interest tours, and weekly events and programs. HuguenotStreet.org for more information.
And here we are back with these wonderful doctors, Dr. Ira Zakon and Dr. Courtney Bulomo, and they're hematologists, and they are at the top of their game. And now we are at the lightning round. We've got everybody on a phone, so I hope you don't mind if we don't give you all the time you need. But I really want to try to get everybody in, if it's okay
yeah.
with everybody.
Sure.
Okay,
absolutely.
So let's go to Bob in Fonda. Okay, Bob, you're on.
Yes, my question's about bone scans for diagnosis. Got 4 or 5 places where I've got joint and other pain, try to rule out Lyme disease and arthritis, and recommendations of bone scan. How would that help with the diagnosis?
So it really kind of depends. Most of the time when we're doing bone scans, when we're talking about cancer, we actually are frequently using them as what we call staging. So we know that someone has cancer, and then we're using a bone scan most of the time for what we call our solid tumors, like prostate and lung and breast, things like that, to see whether or not someone has cancer within their bones. It's actually a great scan to look at that. If you really have joint problems, sometimes a bone scan doesn't always help unless your doctor is worried about cancer. But we do use them when we talk about staging someone for their cancer.
Okay, so when it gets that far, very quickly, Courtney, I'm so sorry. When it gets that far, can we bring them back from once the cancer reaches their bones?
So it really depends on what type of cancer you have, but even cancers that aren't necessarily curable, we're really moving into the area where many of them are very treatable and can be treatable for, and you know, where you before you used to think weeks to months, it could be years. So yeah. It really depends on the type of cancer.
Gotcha. Okay. So thank you, Bob from Fonda. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob in Gilderland, this Bob. Okay. Bob in Gilderland, your turn.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity. I had a question revolving around MRSA.
Okay. What's your question?
The question is this. I developed MRSA, and it was a strange thing. No outward indication, hiking in the woods one day, the next day I couldn't get out of bed. And it was a long time in the hospital, a long time in rehab, many months to get from a wheelchair to the walker to finally walking with a cane. They said it was colonized in my knee. I was supposed to get a knee replacement, and they said they couldn't do it because of this MRSA being colonized in the knee.
Okay.
Is it a way of curing this thing, or is it ever going to be, is this just something that I'm going to have to live with the rest of my life?
Right. So MRSA is a type of bacteria, and it can live in our skin, and many of us may carry it. The problem with it is that it sometimes it's resistant to some of the common antibiotics. It's very treatable. But when it causes infections, sometimes it becomes more complicated.
Do we have the right antibiotics by now? Because I know in the beginning there was a real fear that, we didn't have anything powerful.
Yeah, enough. No, we still have effective antibiotics to treat it. In the hospital setting, there's a lot of attention just to prevent it spreading
sure.
around. But in terms of putting a new knee joint in, their concern is they need to know for sure over a long time that there is no active bacteria because you don't want to infect an artificial knee. That's a disaster. But I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, so I can't speak to how they think about that over time, but that's
okay.
something to ask your surgeon.
Yeah. Just one quick one, and I'll get off you. One minute I was walking around like anybody else, and the next day I couldn't get out of bed, and there was no outward indication I had MRSA. No, I didn't know, and the hospital didn't know until they made a lot of tests. I didn't know MRSA attacked you in that way. I thought it was an open sore.
Well, usually it has to have some way of getting into, like under the skin, into the skin, and it can sometimes be something innocent. It could be a little abrasion or something where there's an opening in the skin, and if it happens to get in enough where it causes an infection, then you could feel sick over a short time.
But it affects you that way, where you can walk in one minute and you're not walking in the other? I have no pain.
If it causes, sometimes an infection causes a very severe reaction from your own body to try
okay.
and counteract it, and there's a lot of things that happen inside you with your immune system that can make you feel very ill very quickly, and that's why it's important then that they, you know, make a diagnosis quickly and get on the right antibiotics.
Hey, Bob, good luck with that.
I'm sorry, what?
Good luck.
Thank you, and thank you for your advice. I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
Okay, let's go to Maria in Springfield. Maria, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Very quick question. My nephew is very healthy. He is 29. And routine blood test, his doctor told him that his white blood cell count was at 50% of the low end of normal. And he said, don't worry about it because everything else was fine. Is that reasonable?
So you know, it is. We actually see a lot of people with low white blood cell counts. It can actually, when they looked to determine what the range of low white blood cell count, what white blood cell count should be, it was from Caucasian 21-year-old men who live in Kansas. So if anyone doesn't fit exactly into that box, it's frequent that your white blood cell can be a little low or a little high. Most people who aren't, if your white blood cell is to the point that it's so low that you're feeling very tired or you're having frequent infections, that's when you worry. If he's 29 and running around and doing pretty well, 99 out of 100 times we say that it's nothing to worry about. It just might be his normal. And
okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good day.
Thanks, Maria. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You make the call, we'll try to get to you. Let's go to Abraham in Enfield, Connecticut. Abraham.
Hello. In 2002, I had Hodgkin's disease. And I was given chemotherapy. The drug regimen was ABCD. And the infusion times, the time that it takes to put the chemotherapy inside, it was about 4 to 5 hours, as I remember. Now, on the third time I went there, we were running late, and they did the infusion in about 2 hours, and I fell asleep during that time. I used to come back every 2 weeks for another chemotherapy session.
Right.
And when I came back, there was a big commotion there. They sent my blood out to the outside lab, and I had ended up with a very high blood cell count. So my question is, did the 2 hours of infusion time, what would the consequences of that be?
So, you know, when we give chemotherapy for any disease, there's different chemotherapy drugs that are used. They each have a particular dose that's used for that patient, and they have a range of time that they would be given. You're talking about intravenous drugs, so they're given as a drip into your bloodstream.
Yes.
So there are standards and ranges, and that's kind of what we need to follow when we administer drugs. So I can't really speak to whether that was appropriate or inappropriate, but the reaction that you're describing, I guess I'm not sure I understand having an elevated white blood cell count, because that we wouldn't relate particularly to chemotherapy or what time it was given over, because chemotherapy, the main issue is it can lower the blood counts during therapy, and that's what we expect, including what you had for treatment of your Hodgkin's.
What did they tell you, Abraham?
Excuse me?
What did they tell you? What was the reason?
They didn't tell me anything. It's just that at the end of the treatment, I ended up with neuropathy in my hands and lower limbs.
Okay, so neuropathy, which we mentioned before, the numbness and tingling, that can happen as a side effect of one of the chemotherapy drugs that you mentioned in your ABVD. It's called chemotherapy. And that drug actually is given over a very short time. It can take 5 or 10 minutes to put in. That's probably not the drug that you're referring to that was longer or given over a shorter time. But it is just, you know, all therapies, unfortunately, have some potential side effects. I think things go overall pretty well for most patients, and we manage through those things, but it is possible to have a lingering side effect from a treatment that, though, cured you. You're here talking to us, thank goodness for that.
Well, that's true, yes. It just surprised me that the first one, two were quite long, 4 or 5 hours, and then the third one, when we were rushed, it was getting late, it only lasted 2 hours, and I thought that maybe...
Yeah.
But so I can't
speak
any,
to that, other than there are guidelines, and we all have to adhere to the proper guidelines of how these drugs are administered.
Abraham, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Goodbye.
Okay. So we have some free phones here. It's up to you. You want a fast one, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Eugene in Queensbury. Okay, Eugene.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm 80 years old. I've had my blood checked for many years, and I've had nervous counts that were low or high, but everything's been fine. I'm in great shape. But the other day I had a blood check, and I was told that my potassium was at the high end, that the high end of the potassium is somewhere around 5.1, and I was 5.2. Well, I don't know what potassium is, really. I thought maybe that was something in dynamite. I don't know what it is and whether I need to be concerned about it at my age. I do know that bananas are loaded with it. And they were telling me, too, that vegetables, green vegetables, is something I should cut back on. Can you tell me a little about that?
Right. So potassium is actually an electrolyte that lives with inside your cells. So a couple things can cause an elevated potassium in the blood. One, and probably the most common, is that the blood sat for too long and those cells broke down a little bit in the blood tube, and then it looks like you have an elevated potassium when you really don't. It's more of an artifact of the blood. Some medications, some blood pressure medications, can cause an elevated potassium, but honestly, most things that we check in the blood, they do have ranges, but everything has a certain amount of lab error. So 5.2 is probably the same as 5 or 5.1, so I wouldn't be worried about it. I just think that your doctor should probably recheck your blood, which I'm sure they're planning to do anyway, and make sure that things are okay. And you are right. Bananas are a great source of potassium, as are leafy green vegetables. So cutting out on those for until you get your blood rechecked, I think, is a good idea.
Okay, but following up on Eugene's very good question is too much potassium bad for you?
So too much potassium can be bad for you.
How so?
And the reason it can is because when you have too much of this electrolyte in your bloodstream, it can actually tickle your heart and cause abnormal heart rhythms. But most of the time it happens when that's up in more of the 6.5 to 7 range. So a 5.2, I don't think that you should be worried.
Terrific answer. Eugene, thank you very much for calling. Okay, we'll go to Marie in New York. Okay, Marie, you're on.
Yes, hi. So I've been experiencing balance issues. I haven't been dizzy, but I just feel like I'm constantly swaying. And I've been feeling this way since November. And, like, they tested my blood. Like, I'm not vitamin deficient. I thought it was, like, a vitamin D deficiency. But they said basically that, like, my vitamins are really high, but I got tested positive for ANA antibody, I believe it was. And,
yes.
I mean, they said that swayingness isn't a... like, they said that wouldn't really constitute to that, but I also didn't experience, like, muscle switching. What do you think? Like, it's really scary, to be honest, you know?
Okay, so I guess there's two things that I could answer you. The blood test called ANA, which means anti-nuclear antibody, it's looking for a protein that we sometimes see in what we call autoimmune diseases, where your own immune system can attack some part of your body that causes a disease, but it's not a very specific test. If someone really thought there was autoimmune disease, they have to do further testing and really get to that. The other side, you're really, at least listening to you, you're describing what may be nervous system symptoms, neurologic symptoms of the nerves or the muscles, and how you sense your balance. And mm-hmm. If your doctor, your family doctor, is concerned enough about that, it's a neurologist, a specialist in the nervous system, that would be best to evaluate that further, because it's not really what we do, but that's how I would think about it, just listening to what you're describing.
Okay. Marie, I'm so sorry. I got to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Randy in Atlanta. Real fast, Randy, what do you got? Bring it. Randy.
Yes, I was calling regarding my blood type. My physician told me that I was A and B positive. It was rare blood. I just wanted to know some of the positives and negatives of being A and B positive blood.
Oh, so actually, you get your blood by both your parents, which means one of your parents has an A gene and one of your and your other parent has a B gene, and that's how you ended up A B positive. The bonus to an A B positive is that you can actually, what we call, you're the universal acceptor, so you can get blood from anyone. So actually having, it is a rare blood type, but actually having that sort of blood is not a bad thing for you at all. It's a good thing.
For example, if you hopefully never in a bad accident and you need to be transfused blood, for me, they might have to find the right match, get the right type for you. If in an emergency, they don't have to worry about which blood type they give you, because you won't reject it.
So you're in luck, Randy.
Okay, thank you all very much, and have a blessed day.
Yeah, you too.
You too. Okay, very quickly, we're almost out of time. Tara, it has to be in one sentence and a one-sentence answer. Go ahead.
Well, I've been tested numerous times for blood in the urine, not visible, but they said it was just my body makeup. Should I be concerned?
Well, it's very hard for me to answer that. I think there are reasons that definitely there are people that can have microscopic blood in the urine, and it is not a concern if it's been evaluated and they know that there's no reason of concern. Of course, there are people where it is a sign of something that is not right and needs to be evaluated further. So that's just kind of, I can't guide you more than that. But if they've seen it repeatedly and you've never developed any concerns over many years, that's always reassuring.
Okay.
Okay.
Hey,
Tara,
so thank you so much for your call. I'm so sorry to leave CJ on the air, but we're going to have to, because we are literally out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in. I'd also like to thank Dr. Ira Zacon and Dr. Courtney Belomo for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toppercin, creams designed to heal muscle aches, back, neck, and shoulder pain, injuries, carpal tunnel, and more. Toppercin.com. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Make sure you take WAMC. Download our new mobile app for streaming audio, headlines, podcasts, and more. Just go to iTunes or Google Play App Store, search WAMC, and install. And remember the lockbox, because we can't do this kind of programming, and I know how important it is to so many of you. We can't do it without your help. We can't do it without you. And right now there's $25,000 that Mr. Big has given us if we can make $200,000. Okay, guys, I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.